Session number 14143.
Mr. Langford, reel 2.
I didn't turn in, having come off watch. I was waiting for the news, but at 8 o'clock that morning we heard that the Bismarck had sunk the Hood. Now, this was a terrible blow, because the Hood stood for everything naval any Royal Naval sailor knew. It was the epitome of our power at sea. So we were a little downhearted at this, and although we'd heard that our skipper beforehand, thinking that we were bound to run into the Bismarck, was contemplating making a torpedo attack on the Bismarck, I think this shook us even as much as the sinking of the Hood, because we wouldn't obviously have stood any chance against the Bismarck. I don't suppose we would have got close enough to deliver a torpedo attack, except that visibility wasn't too good, so we may have stumbled onto her, but I don't think in those days she had radar. We hadn't by that time. No, they wouldn't have radar. So it's just possible we might have stumbled across her. But as it happened, of course, having sunk the Hood, she altered course, and we passed by her and got to Reykjavik safely.
Coming back to the condition of the ship, was it laid out and was it equipped like a Royal Navy ship, or were there big differences apart from the ice cream machine?
Well, there were big differences in that, of course, on a Royal Navy ship, we would have all slung our hammocks, and the American destroyers had bunks, so everybody had bunks, except for the odd ones that, if we were overcrewed, one or two had to sling their hammocks, but in the main, everybody had a bunk, and this was the biggest difference to Navy ships. But
you were telling me about the twin screws on the ship. Can you repeat what you were saying earlier off the record?
Yes. We'd always found that they were difficult ships to manage to come alongside. For one thing, coming alongside alongside a jetty could be difficult. And I think this was mainly due to the fact that the twin screws were situated very close to each other, and so if you was manoeuvring a stern port and forward starboard, it didn't quite give you the feel that a captain would get with a Royal Naval ship with the screws slightly further apart.
Was it a happy ship to live and work in?
It was a very happy ship, and I put this down, of course, to the officers that we had aboard. We had two young sub-lieutenants. One was an American, David Gibson, and the other was an English lad, although he's now a Canadian in Canada. These two were great fun to be with on the bridge. In fact, number two captain, Captain Tom Taylor, was even known to have told these sub-lieutenants off for fraternizing with the lower deck. But that's how happy the ship was, because all the officers at that time would pass the time of day and be as friendly as officer rating can be to one another. This, I think, was the main reason for it being a happy ship. But proof of it being a happy ship is the fact that since those days, we've found 129 of that ship's company, and only illness or lameness or such like has kept them from coming to reunions, which we've so far had 14.
What memories have you got about the captains of the ship when you were with her?
Here again, we were very fortunate with the captains. The first captain was Commander Bostock, and he was a father-like figure. Would grunt his replies to you if he was taking the signal round to him in the wardroom or his cabin, and he would say yes and grunt in a father-like manner to you, and you felt this was good. This was good. The second captain, Captain Tom Taylor, we called him Buck Taylor, bring them back alive, Buck, which was a safari sort of greeting in those days. He was a much sterner man, but a fair man, and if so long as you didn't do something wrong, you were okay by him. Yes, he was a great guy. Our third captain was Captain Medley, he was on us for about 6 months because eventually he took over the Canadian corvette, Canadian destroyer Saskatchewan, and he took our chief yeoman with him there. After that, we got a two-winger as our captain, and this was Lieutenant Rankin, who had come from submarines, and he was also very, very popular aboard ship. The first recollection of him is seeing him throw a piece of cod line with a hook on the end of it over the side fishing. And I think other lads were fishing at the same time, so it was a fishing angling contest, more or less.
Was all your work in the Burnham in the North Atlantic?
Yes, we had a refit in Charleston, South Carolina, and we had one towards the end of our career in the London docks. But apart from that, it was completely North Atlantic, except for one trip down. I believe there was a great shortage of oil up in the north of northeast of America and Canada, and we went down with three tankers to Trinidad. Port of Spain, Trinidad, and escorted them back. So that was a pleasant change from the North Atlantic when we got down there. But it didn't take long to get back to Halifax, Nova Scotia. So from the thinnest of cotton clothes, we were back in, swathed in our thick woolly underwears and balaclavas and the rest of it within a few days.
Did you have the impression that the Germans were winning the Battle of the Atlantic?
It seesawed. There were times when we thought we had them, and there were times when we thought, my goodness, aren't things going badly, you know. I think this was particularly true of the times when we suffered naval setbacks, like the sinking of the Hood, like the sinking of the Prince of Wales, and so forth. This always brought a little bit of gloom to the mess deck, but British Matlow is a pretty resilient sort of fellow. He's back up the next minute. And I don't think we ever doubted that eventually, with American help, we would survive. I'm sure that was the back of everybody's mind, that we would eventually survive.
You felt that even in, when you first joined her at the end of 1940?
Yes. Everybody knew that things were tough, and we were expecting, of course, an invasion at that time. And when it didn't come, I think it made us realise that that we stood a chance. I think up to that point, I think we were very, very dodgy, very doubtful about our capacity to resist a German invasion so early on in the war. But then it never came, and it never came, and it never came. And this made us think, well, we can't be doing so bad if he doesn't come across and start on us. So gradually the feeling got stronger and stronger. And of course, after Pearl Harbor, the 7th of December 41, we thought, well, this really has brought the Americans in with us. And I don't think we looked back from that time.
Any other incidents that stick out in your mind from the time of the Burnham?
We were in convoy on one occasion when Winston Churchill had been across to Newfoundland, Argentia, I think it was, to have a meeting with Roosevelt, and on his way back on the Prince of Wales, he steamed through our convoy, and having got steamed right the way through the convoy, turned round and steamed all the way back. I remember that particular occasion because we'd been visited by an aircraft earlier on lunchtime that day, and he'd signalled to us that the Prince of Wales, with Churchill aboard, was likely to contact the convoy around about 6 o'clock in the evening. And I remember at that time we were at the head of the convoy, being senior officer, and there was a corvette astern of the convoy. I know the name, Agassiz, A-G-A-S-S-I-Z. And I was on watch, I think it was the first dog, and I got a, she was flashing up, and she said, several ships approaching from astern. So I showed Captain the message, and he said, right, reply, do not attack, it is the Prince of Wales. Everybody laughs, of course, and that was that. Of course, the corvette knew it was the Prince of Wales anyway, too. But as I say, she steamed right the way through the convoy, and having got to the top, she went all the way round us and back down the other side. Made a flag signal, which I think has been well and truly recorded.
What was that?
I've got the exact words upstairs because I made a note of the signal for posterity, but it's tucked away somewhere. But it was to the effect that Churchill wished us a bon voyage and a pleasant trip. And I think we just said thank you very much, sir, and left it at that. Because another idiosyncrasy of those four funneled ships, which I haven't mentioned, is the fact that the steering was a most Heath Robinson affair of cables and pulleys. And it went from the bridge down to one pulley, and across to the side of the ship, and another pulley. And this cable went all the way down the upper deck until it got to the tiller flat, where it would go down another series of pulleys and eventually make contact with the with the rudder for steering port or starboard. And of course, being a wire cable, it was prone to all sorts of things happening. Mostly it snapped somewhere or other, or got jammed in one of the pulleys, so that we were constantly finding ourselves without steering, and having to steer on the twin screws, which I already said was sometimes a little bit dodgy. And on other occasions, of course, even as well as the steering, the ship's engines might falter. And on several occasions, I can remember that we were in the middle of the convoy, and only by good seamanship of the various captains of steering on the screws were we able to keep from hitting some of these. In fact, I think it was the Renown was once with us on convoy, and we went very, very close to her because of this same fault in the steering. So there was always the chance of a bit of excitement from that. The other enemy that, of course, we had was the sea. In fact, it ran the U-boat a very close second, in that we, on one occasion, had been through what was reckoned to be the worst storm in 50 years, and the whole of the upper deck was a mangle of twisted stanchions, and the boats had all been washed away. Nothing was in an upright condition. Nobody was allowed to go along the upper deck. That lasted for 24 hours at least. And this was just the sea had done all this damage. The bridge was stove in, which was often happening. And another occasion we got in the eye of a hurricane. This was lovely for about 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. The sun was shining, a blue sky. And then after a quarter of an hour, a wall of sea, must have been all of 40 foot high, just came upon us before we had time to manoeuvre, and hit us square amidship so that we rolled over. I think the roll that we recorded, because we had a recorder in the navigating office, was 57 degrees. I seem to remember it because of the Heinz contact for 57. And we were back in the storm right away then. Oh yes, the sea was just as much an enemy at times.
Did you ever think the ship could be capsized by the storms?
Yeah, I think we weren't the only ones to think that at times, because of course the Admiralty did reduce a lot of top hamper. It took off a couple of the 4-inch guns we had. We had one port starboard side by the funnels. It took them off. It took two sets of torpedo tubes. We used to have four sets of three torpedo tubes, and so we were down to two sets of three. We had the three of the funnels were cut down to reduce a bit of the height. So I think we weren't the only ones to imagine that we could possibly capsize. And of course there were occasions when we were so covered with ice that I think this was a real possibility.
Now, coming on to January 44, when I think you went into combined ops.
Oh yes, I became I picked up the hook of 18 leading signalman, and had to leave the ship because we already had a leading signalman aboard ship. So I went back to Chatham Barracks and got a week's leave, and was called back halfway through it, and was given a draft chit to, and it was called Party Funshaw. This didn't mean a lot to me at the time because they sent me back on another week's leave, and that was more important than what does party funshawe mean. But when I got back to barracks, I found that it was first of all to be kitted out in army gear, as well as carrying full kit bag and hammock everywhere, and to do combined ops training somewhere in Hampshire. I can't remember where now, the name of the place. And teamed up with, given a team of seven. There were eight of us altogether. There was myself with two signalmen, and there was a leading telegraphist with two ordinary telegraphists and two seamen. And we were given much equipment, radio receivers and transmitters, a donkey engine for charging batteries, signal lamp, Aldis lamp and flags, and a handcart to push it all in, and a tent, and a bicycle. We had to look after this, and finally we were sent out to Essex to live off the land, although living off the land meant in the tent and catching what we could. We got eggs, and we caught a rabbit and this sort of thing, but mainly the backup was the Royal Marines, who were on the similar sort of course, had their own galley, and we could go in with them for meals whenever we hadn't got anything of our own. And we could also go out at night to the local pub, and they always had odds and ends that you could nibble on. Finally, we were coming up to the end of May. We were transported back into a sealed camp in Hampshire.
Were you told what party funshawe was supposed to be?
We got a briefing somewhere along the line. I didn't think it was a terribly good briefing. I wasn't told the name of the place we were going to land at. I was told it would be cobbled streets. I was told that there was a crucifix standing up, which would be a good landmark, and that I was to set up a signal party on the beach to guide craft into the river and down into the basin in town. That was about all I was told, so I didn't know the name of the place, and as it happened, I was just dropped off a mile or so to the right of Courcelles, which was the place that I was supposed to be at, Courcelles-sur-Mer, and the wrong side of the river. So, of course, I had to go across on a diagonal route to the town and cross at the only bridge and then walk back up from there. Now, this was about 1 o'clock in the afternoon of D-Day, and I understood that the Canadians who'd taken the beach at Juno Beach at Courcelles were by now best part of a mile inland from the coast. So this was reassuring news. I was met by a commanding officer, 2.5 ringer, and he sent me off towards the coast to set up the signal station. When I got there, the beach was cleared, had been cleared of bodies, and the Royal Engineers were going over the beach with their detectors, searching for mines. And they said, "Where had I come from?" And I said, "From down there," pointing down the river. And they said, "Well, you were lucky because we haven't cleared that part yet." So their luck held anyway.
Did you feel that you'd been used as a guinea pig?
I thought so, because the lieutenant commander had had said which way to go and was following me, but he was following me at a fair old distance. And every time I turned round, he was still a similar distance behind, and he stopped too, and didn't mean anything to me because I was so naive. He'd called me yeoman, and this was the first time I'd been called a yeoman. I thought, yeah, I'm doing very well at this. It wasn't till I got on the beach and these chappies said how lucky we'd been that I was able to turn round to him, still 20 yards or so astern, and say, weren't we lucky, sir? And indeed we were, because there were mines strewed about the other side of the river. Not an hour later, a jeep was going by with two officers in it, and all of a sudden there was a thud, and it was up for 10, 15, 20 foot in the air, and the two bodies thrown out. So there were some odd ones around.
I think we've jumped a little bit ahead. If I can go back to when you were going into the holding camp before D-Day, can you pick up the story back from there, please? And then we can deal with how you crossed the Atlantic. Okay.
Oh, yes. We went into this sealed camp, which was supposed to be sealed, but strangely enough, we did get out to the local pub as a final gesture that we were going to use our initiative in all things. This was something that we had been told in briefing to use initiative and so forth. So we used it on this last occasion to get a pint of beer. And then, of course, we were moved down to Portsmouth, and it was the 5th, of course, the 5th of June, when I was put aboard this LST. For some reason or other, we went in different groups. I didn't have my team of seven with me. One had gone with the lieutenant commander, and the other six had gone by some other means. But I found myself on this LST with three naval officers who were mine disposal bods, so I felt fairly safe with those. We went aboard the LST, and by the night we were afloat, and I remember going on the upper deck and looking around and seeing all the vast convoy of ships all around, all going across the channel in one direction. Anyway, we must have arrived because we'd either dropped anchor or stopped some distance away from the shore. Obviously, the LST captain was waiting for instructions to come in. It was obvious to me that we weren't going to get ashore before lunchtime, so I made my way down to the Vitlin office and made sure that I was vittled in for rum. And I said, and I've got three more with me. What are their names? Well, fortunately, I knew their names, but not their official numbers. So when up spirits was piped, I was able to draw four tots of rum.